Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Have a day. Aloha ka ko and good for the morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Egid Wo, and I appreciate your company this morning. And today on the show, heated debate online over PNG's Chief of Justice allegedly failing to declare additional income over several years. People from all over Australia have travelled to Parliament House in Canberra this week to address the countless shortfalls of the PALM scheme. And speaking of PALM scheme, a Solomon Island PALM scheme worker found dead on the side of the road. A year later, family are still awaiting answers. Also, how critical is it for this year's pre-COP meeting in the Pacific? Stay tuned for those stories and more here on Pacific Beat, where we acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But let's get on with the show. I say ngā mihi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a former Chief Justice of Papua New Guinea says the current Chief Justice is entitled to the presumption of innocence over allegations of misconduct in office. The Ombudsman Commission has referred Sir Gibb Sirleka to the public prosecutor, alleging he failed to declare additional income for himself and his wife over several years. The public prosecutor says the amount he allegedly failed to declare is around 2 million kina, or $650,000 between 2017 and 2024. The prosecutor is currently examining the evidence to determine whether to request the National Executive Council appoint a leadership tribunal. Sir Gibb's referral is unprecedented and has shocked many Papua New Guineans and sparked heated debate on social media. Sir Arnold Ahmet was PNG's second Chief Justice and says he too was shocked, but he's urging people to let the legal process take its course. Here he is, speaking to our PNG reporter, Belinda Cora.
Because it is one of the highest positions in the country, there being three who had the three arms of government, the Prime Minister, the Speaker who leads Parliament, and the Chief Justice, the judiciary. And so I am familiar with that leadership responsibility at the highest level. And so it was a shock, I imagine, for the members of the public as well. Any leader who is accused and alleged of having committed any offence, whether that be a leadership code type offence or a criminal offence or any type of misconduct at the highest levels, is concerning for the country. The highest levels of leadership are judges, members of parliament, cabinet ministers, and speaker, prime minister, and the chief justice. So it being one of the three most senior positions in the country, constitutionally, it is serious for the country.
What did you think about the amounts of monies allegedly involved?
Well, obviously, as a former jurist, those are allegations, and it would be most inappropriate for me to make any observations at all. Those are matters that are alleged, and the Chief Justice obviously has a right to presumption of innocence and to have that proven properly, appropriate tribunals. So I am not really at liberty to make any observations about any of it.
Should the Chief Justice be able to provide a public explanation of the source of the additional income, regardless of what happened next?
Well, I think the process would have been thorough by the Ombudsman Commission. When a leader is being investigated and evidence has been gathered those allegations and the evidence are put to the leader for the leader to respond to before the Ombudsman Commission makes a decision whether or not to refer. I have written this in judgments numerous times as a judge and as a Chief Justice in the Supreme Court. And so any leader, including the Chief Justice or the Prime Minister, for instance, like Grand Chief Sir Michael in 2011, would have been provided the basis of the allegations and to have been given the opportunity to have responded to that amply before the Ombudsman Commission would have made a decision whether or not to refer the matter to the public prosecutor.
So, Arnold, are you able to just tell us, is this the first time from your experience as well that a Chief Justice has been referred to the public prosecutor from Ombudsman Commission? And what happens next? Can you take us through that?
It is the first time there have been judges who have been referred, but it is the first time a serving Chief Justice since independence. I am familiar with all the presiding Chief Justices prior to independence and since independence, and our national Chief Justices, our first being Sir Bury Kiddu. I was the second. The third was Sir Murray Karpi. The fourth was Sir Salomo Injia. And Sir Gibbs Salika is the fifth. And so it is the first time a Chief Justice is being so referred by the Ombudsman Commission. The constitutional processes for the senior leaders that I referred to, particularly the Chief Justice, Prime Minister, decisions that go to the National Executive Council, as probably would be aware, not so long ago in 2011, the Founding Father Grand Chief was referred, and a panel of overseas judges were appointed by the National Executive Council at the time. And so for the other head of the arm of government, the Chief Justice, it would be a matter that the National Executive Council would have to deliberate on, should the matter be referred to them by the public prosecutor. So presently, the referral has been to the public prosecutor, the principal prosecuting constitutional office holder in the country under the Constitution, who has the primary responsibility to determine whether or not there is enough evidence to seek the National Executive Council's deliberation to consider appointing a tribunal. And such a tribunal for a Chief Justice or a Prime Minister would be from overseas jurisdictions comparable to ours, that is commonly Australia, New Zealand, and some of the Pacific countries like Fiji, Solomon Islands, Samoa, Tonga.
What is your biggest concern right now?
I think, like all allegations under our legal and judicial system, they remain allegations, and there is a natural justice right to presumption of innocence. I think judges and lawyers and many will understand that, and we should all admit the system of justice that we have adopted, which in my view is resilient, constitutional structures that people's individuals' rights and freedoms and presumptions of innocence can be protected. And so whilst the public may have some concerns, I think they can be assured that the system of justice is resilient and can be allowed to be enforced, the rights and presumptions can be preserved in due process. That's what's called the rule of law.
And that there is former PNG Chief Justice Sir Arnold Ahmed speaking to our PNG reporter, Belinda Cora. Right, seasonal workers from the Pacific have become invaluable to the Australian economy in areas like agriculture, aged care, meat processing and hospitality. The Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, or better known as PALM, has also provided much needed income for workers and remittances for island nations. But horror stories continue to emerge about unscrupulous, abusive employers and poor working and living conditions. To address these shortcomings and to improve the scheme, people from all over Australia have travelled to Parliament House in Canberra this week. Lucy Cooper reports.
Tasmania's central coast is a hub of agricultural activity, and it depends on Pacific seasonal workers, according to local mayor Cheryl Fuller.
We are really reliant on those folks for berry picking and vegetable picking. And our community embraces those workers. We have an annual festival where we join together and celebrate, and our churches are strongly connected to the workers that come to our region. Certainly an essential workforce for the Northwest Coast.
She's in Canberra this week to attend the PALM Futures Forum as a member of the Mayoral Alliance for the Pacific, which aims to support local councils to engage more effectively in the PALM scheme. The forum seeks to implement the recommendations made in the report Improving PALM, published by the Scanlon Institute this year. These recommendations echo those made by other stakeholders over the years.
There is a number of recommendations in the report, but based on my experience, the three that stand out for me, it is the flexibility for them to move across employers when needed. I believe that whilst they are here, they should have access to Medicare. I know that that comes as a cost to the Australian taxpayer, but I think that the benefits outweigh the financial burden and their opportunity to perhaps create a pathway to permanent citizenship, I think is useful, particularly for Tasmania, and that's something that I would like the government to really explore.
It's not just mayors in the halls of Parliament this week. The forum has brought together key community members, employers, unions, researchers, PALM stakeholders and parliamentary representatives. Zeb Riddell works for the Adcor Group, an improved employer of the PALM scheme, which brings workers to Australia and places them with businesses across agriculture, meat processing and aged care.
It's ironic that it's called international labour mobility when they really don't have the option for mobility.
He said he was attending the forum to call for greater rights for Adcor's employees.
I'm all for mobilisation, meaning, you know, candidates being able to choose what employer or host employer they wish to work for. I think there still needs to be some governance around that process. However, I think there's only benefits from it.
He says there needs to be harsher penalties for approved employers doing the wrong thing.
We hear of it, we see it, and it seems to be that sometimes there can be failure to act on approved employer until that is doing the wrong thing, until sometimes it's too late.
Mr. Riddell said most companies Adcor sends workers to can't survive without the scheme.
There is a client that we have in Castlemaine that deal in pork, and the running joke there is that they always say to us when I go out to see them is that we save their bacon.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to tell you that receiving clear information and communication would greatly benefit PALM scheme workers. But it's a gap that exists according to attendees of the forum. Sione Hepoto said it was important that workers have access to someone who looks and sounds like them.
I think a lot of the times we can't speak on people's experience unless we have experienced or we understand where those people are coming from. And so I think it's great that we have allies for PALM workers and all that stuff, but I think having people that look like them and sound like them, represent them, I think that will translate better across, you know, all forms of politics or administration or whatever it may be.
Mr. Hepoto is a ministry candidate for the Uniting Church of Australia and a member of the Pacific Australia Emerging Leaders Summit Network.
Most of the people that I'm engaging, you know, which we give respite to some of them who have need a break from thing or need a touch with family around them. But most of them agree that, you know, the scheme itself is good, but just some discrepancies around sometimes pay or deductions are troubling.
He's calling for greater resourcing for those who volunteer their time and money to support PALM scheme workers.
A lot of the stuff around wellbeing, social services, belonging and what church places or community groups or sports teams and that are doing that are actually voluntarily like caring for the PALM workers when they come to Australia to work. What I'm here advocating for is that the government can create a better relationship and be able to resource some of these voluntary community-led initiatives. They're just doing it with the best that they can, but without really any kind of resources other than their own hands, you know. And as we know, like, you know, the well-being of employees in any environment goes a long way to benefiting the companies and the economy.
For Zeb Riddell of Adcor Group, the PALM scheme should continue to evolve to fill future labour gaps.
I think what a lot of people forget too is, yes, PALM scheme is for unskilled, but we have a lot of Pacific Islanders that are skilled as well. So I think for me, how I'd like to see the future of PALM is that it broadens a bit. If you have a look at things like infrastructure in Australia, if you look at the Olympic Games coming up in 2032, I definitely feel that even under the PALM scheme, if the industry was open to construction, you'd definitely see, you know, more, I guess, impact for not only here in Australia, but for our people back home.
And that there is Zeb Riddell, Managing Director of PALM Scheme Approved Employer Adcor Group, ending that report from Lucy Cooper.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
So, Litiana, do you encounter vaccine hesitancy, particularly on social media?
Not much now. In the 2013 EPI coverage survey, we found out that there was a 0.9% of hesitancy.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We are staying with the PALM scheme. The story here, almost 12 months since Arjun Kuni was found dead on the side of the road in the early hours of the morning. His family is still grieving and desperate for answers. The 36-year-old Solomon Islander was walking to the poultry farm where he worked about 4:30 a.m. on Monday, April 28th, 2025, when he was the victim of a hit-and-run, police believe. He came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. His sister, Margaret Natalie Cooney, told Lucy Cooper months of investigation has so far failed to lead to any answers.
I was Arjun's elder sister, and upon arrival here, I haven't settled. And then the incident happened. That was on April. And then to me, it's such a shocking incident. It was a shocking death for me. And since the time the event happened or the death occurs, I feel like it's really traumatic for me as a sister. And like in our upbringing, we raise up extendedly, we care for each other. And in our old cultural way, as an elder sister, as a firstborn of a family, you always take up the responsibility of the mother or father to care for your siblings. So it's really painful. That is why I have to call. And then I just want to know, like, if there is any proof about the date, any witness that they can reach out and just let us know so that I have peace in my heart. Like, now I still not have peace about the death of my brother.
Are you satisfied with the progress of this investigation?
Like, it takes too long. And for me, I will say that I'm still not satisfied. I want to know if they can come up with the final report that to let me know that, oh, this is the cause of the death. This is how it goes. This is the event. This is where it started. And these are the people's involved. And then I will satisfy. But for now, not yet.
And throughout this process, has the police maintained contact with you, updating you on the investigations?
when I get the body back, I come back here and then I make out time and come over to Great Fit. I was in Great Fit, that was last year around June or July, and then I went to the police station and inquire, and then they give me some of his stuff where they found on his body upon death. And then I asked them, well, I'm interested if you can like just go about the investigation and then let me know, because my family back in the Solomon, and I for one here in Australia, it's really challenging standing up facing this incident, like the event, and then doing paperwork for my late sibling. And they never reach back unless if I give them a call. I give them a call and I ask, oh, is there any update for me? That's the only time we will talk. So I was like, oh, please, I would like you to keep updating me what is going on. And then I feel like, oh, if I was around in Grivet, I will go in front of the police station every day so that they're going to see me there and do something about my late sibling's death.
And I understand that he was in Australia seeking to earn an income to send money back home to his family. How is the rest of his family at home? His children, his wife?
Not good, I will say, like, because when he was here, he support his family. And now, upon his death, the poor wife is not working, and then he has two sons. And I was the one who take up the responsibility to meet the family now, their food, the children's school fee, their lunch money, everything. I made it. So it's quite a challenge for me somehow. But because of our upbringing is that we live extended, we care for each other. So I have to do it. Because if I didn't do it, no one will take up that part to do it. So it's really stressful for me. But the wife and the two children, they miss their father so much.
And for yourself as the elder sister, what do you miss most about him?
I miss him so much because in the family, we two were so close. He's like, our bonding is too close. We used to share things together. We used to call each other. I miss him so much. And even our family, we miss him so much in the family because he came over here and worked here. And then he earned money. He built his own house. And then he contributed a lot in the family. And then sometimes if I saw his pictures, his photos in my phone, I feel like I'm crying. I feel I missed him so much. And with that as well, I would like to say that we have some phone calls, like he sometimes send me some of his voice call, like the message. And sometimes when I think of him, I turn my phone on and listen to his voice and I feel like, oh no, I miss my brother so much. And like for now, I just feel like if they can reach out and then just let me know what is the fact, what is behind the scene of his death.
And that there is Margaret Natalie Cooney, the sister of Arjun Cooney, who was found dead on the side of a road in Griffith, New South Wales in April last year. Now, police are appealing to speak to the driver of a blue sedan or hatchback travelling on Watkins Road shortly before the crash. Anyone with information is urged to contact police or Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000. Now, Turkey's success in getting hosting rights for this year's COP31 was a cause of disappointment for many Pacific Island climate activists who had hoped that having the meeting in the Pacific would give world leaders an on-the-ground look at the impacts of the climate crisis in the Pacific. In a deal with Turkey, Australia maintains presidency over COP31 and a pre-COP meeting will take place in a Pacific Island nation. For many, the pre-COP meeting in the Pacific is critical. Among them is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, Dr. Melanie Pill, who joins us now. And with that, I say good morning, Doctor, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Doctor, look, how much of a difference does having a pre-COP meeting in the Pacific Island nation make in addressing the climate conference itself?
Well, I think that first of all, I think that we still have the pre-COP in the Pacific is very important. And one of really one of the levers that we currently have. So I think that really needs to be used strategically, because that is the opportunity, like you said, also bringing the world's attention to one of the most climate vulnerable regions in the world. So that many see that firsthand, what the forces of nature mean in small island states, like the Pacific, and see what really is at stake. So the pre-COP is really important, even though you might not see leaders coming to the main summit into the region. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, Doctor, how important is it then, you know, with Australia having to play such a lead role, you know, ensuring that Pacific nations get the most out of COP31?
I think it is really important that Australia here continues to play a leadership role and make sure that still Pacific priorities are included in the agenda. And there are certain levers that we still have. So as president of negotiations, Australia can really still execute quite a bit of authority and leading draft texts. So that will be really important in moving forward in the lead up to the COP, using the pre-COP, like I just said, but also at the negotiations.
Do you think, though, it was a mistake for Australia to concede hosting rights to Turkey?
Look, I think the UN rules are that countries need to have consensus of over who is going to be the host. That is the process that needs to be followed. And I think that Australia still had a good outcome instead of not having the COP in the region at all. We do have the pre-COP. We have our climate change minister, Bowen, as the president of negotiations, who in the lead up to the summit will have to really engage also other climate vulnerable countries. So I wouldn't say it was necessarily a mistake, but like you mentioned, I think a lot of the climate community in the region really would have liked to see people traveling to the Pacific. So we still do have opportunities, and I do think that Turkey is also very open to including Pacific concerns and priorities. So I think we still can make this a success, even though it might sound or is a little bit of a setback.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, in terms of climate action, do you think Prime Minister Albanese is doing enough for the Pacific?
I think, well, that's a really difficult, probably a really difficult question. I think we can always do more. There is a lot of things that can be done, but there's also been a lot of things that Australia has already done, in where Australia is already delivering for the Pacific, and with the willingness to host COP31, I think there is progress in moving forward to continue to do that, also in for example through the Australian infrastructure financing facility, the support that Australia has provided to the Green Climate Fund, the support that Australia provided to the Pacific Resilience Facility, which is really a one-of-a-kind financial mechanism in the Pacific and will also take a prominent role during COP, the pre-COP, as well as the main summit. So they are definitely things that Australia is delivering for the Pacific, and it is something I think is really important to them as well, which also the bid for COP31 really showed and the willingness to really hold that. Yeah,
I do want to talk about the fact that, you know, it's COP31, it's been 31 years, and you talk about progress. How much progress have we really reached in the sense that it sort of feels like sometimes a step backwards? Progress. How far do you feel we've come?
I think, that's also a very good question. I think there is a problem or there is always the perception that progress doesn't go fast enough. But the negotiations are really the only lever that we have in order to make sure that countries actually engage and countries commit to more climate action. And we have seen that has happened over the years. And of course, there were setbacks in between. Paris was probably the most important milestone that we have and was really needed. There has been progress, but you're right, it is nowhere near to what we needed. The pledges are not enough to currently reach the 1.5 degree goal. Some pledges have not been made. So progress, yes, but not enough. What is really needed in order to keep our global average temperature rise under 1.5,
yeah,
or not even to 2, yeah.
Doctor, I understand you've actually recently co-authored a paper, right, which stated that Australia can still deliver meaningful outcomes for the Pacific by aligning regional priorities. Can I ask, what did you actually mean by this? Because if anything, what should Australia do as president of negotiations?
So what we meant with that is that it can't. It needs to have a, when we have the pre-COP, a really a shared agenda between the Pacific and other climate vulnerable countries. So there are concerns that the Pacific has, but also other countries that are highly impacted by climate change, and having just a broader audience behind those goals gives you a lot more negotiating power during the negotiation process. And the role that we have as president of negotiation should really be used with intent, really using that authority basically to the max, making sure that what was discussed at pre-COP, the expectations that were set, don't backslide and that they remain on the agenda. And the president of negotiations will hopefully be able to do that. It is a new role. It is not something that has happened before. It's an unprecedented arrangement. What exactly that will look like in the negotiations will remain to be seen, but there's definitely that ambition and that intent already there.
Nice. Okay. Well, look, just as we wrap up, I do want to just get your thoughts on this. For that pre-COP event, right, in the Pacific to be successful, maybe just let us know what really needs to happen. I mean, how will it need to be hosted?
I think what really needs to happen is that leaders need to attend. We need to make a case for global leaders and crucial countries to come to the Pacific, and Australia and the Pacific need to promote and showcase this event as one that cannot be missed, one that they cannot afford to miss, because it would be too consequential for the main summit. So I think this is something that is really important, and I think that is something where Australia can also really lead again and extend invitations to countries to come to the Pacific. And that will not be easy, especially when we're looking at the current concerning conflicts all over the world. So that will be quite a challenge. But I think that is something really important. And we've seen in the Pacific as well that there is obviously the willingness and the plan to use this strategically by holding the pre-COP in Fiji as well as Tuvalu.
Well, Doctor, we really appreciate your insight this morning, and thank you again for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. That was a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, Dr. Melanie Pill.
This Sunday, settle in for the sounds of Womb Adelaide as we bring you Mantis, our 2025 Pacific Break winner, recorded live on stage.
Yeah. Don't try to play with the weatherman. I make it rain fire, call the fireman. All boy come around like a brother man. Me one, me no not a one.
Yes, sir. Catch Mantis set recorded live from Womb Adelaide this Sunday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yeah. Mantis.
I'm your host, Eggy DeWall, and if you've just tuned in, welcome to Pacific Beat. Here's what's been on the show so far. We talked about a heated debate online over PNG's Chief of Justice allegedly failing to declare additional income. People from all over Australia have travelled to Parliament House in Canberra this week to address the countless shortfalls of the PALM scheme. And we just spoke about the importance of the pre-COP meeting being held in the Pacific. Still to come, though, we'll be talking about children in Timor-Leste bearing the brunt of disruptions caused by a changing climate. But right now, let's get into your news wrap. Yes, kia ora koutou katoa. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's brought to you by our producer, Dana Kirimoff, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. Thank you very much. Look, there is a couple of stories we want to get through this morning. We start off in PNG. Mm-hmm. I believe Prime Minister James Marape has announced that he plans to introduce legislation that will outlaw polygamy.
Yes. So yesterday, during discussions on gender-based violence and women's issues in Parliament, Prime Minister Marape and his government announced that they're considering a policy proposal that would see new laws introduced to completely outlaw polygamy. Yeah. Now, Marape acknowledged the need to respect Papua New Guinea's cultural traditions, but some practices, particularly those that put women at risk, must be addressed through national reform, like in this case. And the PM's proposed approach would see the law take effect from 2030 onwards. It wouldn't automatically invalidate existing arrangements, but would prohibit new polygamous arrangements in the future.
Okay. Well, how would banning polygamy actually help the women of PNG?
Yes. So polygamy has a long history in PNG. Its roots are in pre-colonial customs. Mm. However, today, the UN's Division for the Advancement of Women describe polygamy as a harmful practice that is directly linked to violence against women and girls, yes, carried out both by husbands and co-wives.
Wow. And I understand that this is actually not the first time the government has tried to tackle polygamy in PNG, right?
Yeah, this new law may be the end of an ongoing legislative journey for the final outlawing of polygamy outright. Bigamy, which is the act of entering a legal marriage whilst already legally married to someone else, is already officially legal, illegal in Papua New Guinea. But in 2014, the National Civil Registry Office made amendments to the Civil Registration Act so that all marriages, including customary marriages, which were not previously registrable, now had to be registered under law, effectively making them illegal.
Okay.
But Sarah Garup, a human rights social justice advocate in the Juaca province, said that the ban was never really properly enforced.
Wow.
So now, at the very least, as most polygamous marriages are customary marriages, their registration was a step towards the final outlawing, which seems to be in process now.
Which, again, I think going back to the beginning, because you were saying this is probably not even going to come into effect until 2030.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not sure what their legislative process is. Obviously, it's only just been announced that it's going to start. I don't know why it's going to take until 2030 for it to come into effect.
Oh, well, we'll have to definitely keep our eyes and ears on this one and follow that up. I do want to say there is more changes, though, to marriage laws over in Tonga. The government has actually raised the legal marriage age to 18 now.
Yes, yeah. So more in sort of the same area, but different place. The new Civil Registration and Digital Identification Act 2025 has replaced the country's previous births, deaths and marriages legislation. So before now, Tongan law legally recognised marriages for those aged between 15 and 17 with parental consent.
Okay, well, obviously the question is, why the law changed then now?
Yeah, and it's a very similar answer to the previous situation. Yeah. The Women and Children's Crisis Centre, the WCCC, said that this change is a result of years of advocacy aimed at protecting girls from early marriages, which can bar them from things like greater education and personal independence.
Yeah.
In 2015, there were 56 marriages involving people under 18, and in 2016, there were 52.
Wow. Okay. Well, those are some interesting numbers. And I do know quite a few people who obviously got married under the age of 18. And surprisingly, look, they're still together to this day.
Yes,
so do you know, it's one of a, can happen, it can work. It might not work for some others, but yeah.
Yes, yeah.
But yes, but I do understand the protection of that sort of younger marriage.
Absolutely,
for kids.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. All right, now, Samoa, interesting, is having to deal with illegal diving, though, at that Manuanui shipwreck.
Yes, yeah. So obviously we've covered this before at Pacific Bay in terms of the shipwreck itself, but now illegal diving and forced entry at the wreck of the HMNZS Manuanui.
Bit of a mouthful.
Yes, yep. has prompted the Samoan government to increase surveillance of the vessel itself.
Oh, wow.
It sank in October of 2024 off the coast of Upolu after hitting a reef. It spilled hundreds of thousands of litres of diesel
right.
and oil into the ocean. In the time since, though, the Samoan government has ordered a 300-metre radius ban around the vessel, saying that it poses significant risks to divers, but also just fishermen and small craft.
Yeah.
So the vessel is now going to be more closely monitored because they've had reports of divers in the vicinity. And these divers risk getting tangled or trapped in ropes and cables because the wreck itself is still unstable. But the other thing is conditions can now quickly shift due to currents and tides.
That's right.
And there is still a risk of pollutants being released into the ocean from the ship itself. But apart from divers, there's also the wreck itself could pose a risk to just boats nearby,
absolutely.
Hence the 300-metre ban.
Yeah, look, makes sense. Okay, well, look, Dana, thank you very much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Vita. Now, UNICEF says children in Timor-Leste bear the brunt of disruptions caused by a changing climate. More frequent floods, landslides, droughts and extreme heat compound long-standing problems in water, sanitation, nutrition and education. Nearly half of all children are already malnourished. Many lack safe drinking water during heat waves and floods regularly force schools to close. UNICEF's global spokesman James Alder visited Timor-Leste and says that agency is helping the Timorese government to strengthen the resilience of kids and the infrastructure they need to grow up happy and healthy. Here he is speaking to our Timor reporter, Vonya Vieira.
Too often, people around the world think that the climate crisis is abstract. It's not abstract. It's very real for kids and it's very real for children who have pretty much a zero carbon footprint. So it's to see that, try and share that so people can see the child's face of a climate crisis and at the same time see some of the very impressive UNICEF projects and try and then, you know, encourage other donors at a time of a donor crisis to put their hands in their pockets and support the people of Timor-Leste.
So what are the most urgent climate shocks affecting Timor-Leste?
It's a lot, hey. It's they're overlapping. It's droughts, it's floods, it's extreme weather conditions. Only in my 3 days here, I've seen that. I've seen a very major, impressive road, half of it be washed away. I've seen families, you know, lose part of their homes. I've spoken to children who, you know, used to only have to walk a small distance, but now go a lot further because the water system's become polluted. You get that. When there's a flood, you know, water systems tend to become polluted, and that's a greater risk of kids getting sick. So climate crisis is not one part. It impacts all elements of a child. That's why, and people don't realise this, that's why we talk about climate crisis being a children's crisis. When you have floods, when they damage water systems, when they damage sanitation systems, then you're at risk of disease. Once you're at risk of disease, then you have a heightened risk of malnutrition. Already, pretty much one in two girls and boys in Timor-Leste are stunted. That's chronic malnutrition. What that means in a real sense, when a child is stunted, then you can get an irreversible cognitive damage. You restrict a child's learning. So addressing these things is not just a nice thing to have. You're talking about half the population in Timor-Leste being children or early 20s. This is very much the future of the country. So, you know, you cannot afford to have a child population that's stunted. We've seen some very impressive work. You know, UNICEF works with the government. This is the government leads on this, and they are trying very hard to reduce that. But they're trying very hard to reduce it at the same time that a climate crisis, again, which is outside their control. So, again, it's about reminding rich nations around the world that they have a real responsibility both to reduce emissions and to fund that climate adaptations in places like Timor-Leste.
What measure does UNICEF recommend to keep children in school during and after climate shocks?
Yeah, there's a few big things that we do here. I mean, one is a program called Schools Go Home, which is making sure kids can do remote learning. Even in the school where we're sitting right now, we've seen solar panels. Solar panels mean kids have got toilets to access. It's such a basic. Solar panels mean that they've got clean water everywhere. I've just been walking around with children. They've shown me where they walk and they wash their hands in clean water, and then they go into a fantastic community kitchen that again has access to clean water, and they eat well. There's no point in eating if you're going to then get sick. So this school is a great example. Solar panels are just a game changer, and they're not difficult. At the same time, we're trying to get more and more schools with digital projectors and computers for teachers. Teachers here are selfless. They work extremely hard, but you've got to give them the tools that they need so that, again, kids just aren't in school, but in Timor-Leste, they're getting a quality education.
And that's UNICEF's global spokesperson, James Alder, speaking to Vonia Vieira. Now, an exhibition showcasing contemporary works by South Sea Islander artists has opened in the Queensland city of Rockhampton. Called Cane, the exhibition explores the history of blackbirding, a term applied to the trade and indentured labourers who were forcibly taken from the Pacific Islands during the 19th and early 20th centuries. They were coerced into working in Queensland's sugarcane fields. Shari Dwyer is one of the artists whose work is on show.
So my art in particular, I've got two pieces. I've got How It Moves In Me, and this body of work is six floating textiles that I've hand painted on, and it sort of resembles water bodies, which in the space they sort of appear to be to have been pulled out of the water as though they're bodies. The method I use is for the material. Is like a transparent curtain fabric. It's a transparent fabric which also kind of resembles water, like the clearness, the transparency of water.
Why that messaging? What's the metaphor? Like, what's the meaning?
It kind of relates to the way that I was brought up, and it's like my ancestors saying, "Can you hear me now? Like, can you hear our stories now?"
Talking about your South Sea Islander heritage, could you describe your community and your upbringing as a South Sea Islander?
My art, I think it sort of reflects in a lot of my work. There is a big disconnect between myself and my South Sea Island community. So my mum, how I connect with it is through my mum and her stories, because I was brought to Brisbane when I was three. I didn't get to spend as much time with my family up north in Mackay, but I would go back and spend holidays there, and I would get to see the family in that way. Yeah, I used to go and stay with my sister in her commissioned home, go to the river, eat mangoes. I just have really fond memories of being with the family. Yeah, they've really left a mark in me, and yeah, I think I reflect that in my art.
Being an Australian and a South Sea Islander, is there a sort of identity crisis? Sorry, let me rephrase that.
Yeah, big time.
Oh, could you
describe? No, you don't have to rephrase. Yeah, it's definitely been like a bit confusing. There's a lot of different confusing elements of that. And yeah, there's the parts where, yeah, you say to people, even now, I think I was in Sydney like 2 years ago, and I was having a conversation with this woman at the bottle store, and she was like, "Are you from New Zealand?" And I was like, "No." I was like, "No, my family are the South Sea Islanders." And she was like, "Where's that?" And yeah, they just don't, like, it's just not a very known thing. And then people also say like, "Oh, it's Aboriginal." And that's great. Like, I would love that, but it's just, that's not it either. So it's very inconsistent, and yeah, I guess it's been something that I've found difficult to navigate.
And that's Sharia Dwyer, one of the artists whose works from part of the Cane touring exhibition organised by Hervey Bay Regional Gallery is now on view at the Rockhampton Museum of Art. And Shari was talking to Finau Fonua. Now that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember to find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Team will be back at the same time tomorrow though at 6 a.m. PNG time with Leve Movono hosting from Fiji. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. at PNG time. Now, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. Coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. As always, Odua Ofa'atu, thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.